Hello and good day. You are tuned into Warning Shots here on CKUW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKUW's independent international news show, and CKUW 95.9 FM is your listener-driven radio station on the FM dial in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Scott Price. Today is March the 15th, 2013. On today's episode of Warning Shots, you will hear hear from Jawar Mohammed. He's an independent researcher and a recent graduate of Stanford University. He's also attended Oxford, where he did his research on federalism and political party systems. Jawar is a human rights and social justice advocate and has published numerous articles on Ethiopia. So you will hear audio from a speech he gave at an event last Saturday and an interview with CQW News Director Michael Welsh did with him. Jawar, what he's doing is he's kind of explaining the current situation in Ethiopia since Mela Zelawi died, with a particular focus on issues of religious freedom and political freedom in Ethiopia, and some issues there that are related. So all that's coming up, and of course your international news in brief. So stay tuned. But as always, we got a couple of announcements before we get into the main part of the show. So, now there are many locally produced spoken word shows that cover events in an engaging and in-depth manner on CKW 95.9 FM. There's People of Interest, Mud and Water, Inner City Voices, Black Mass, Say It Sista, and the Global Research News Hour. So, for all that information on that, check out the broadcast schedule for show times and for free show archives, CKW.ca. Or, you know, to stream it wherever you are around the world, you can stream it or get it as a podcast from CKW.ca, which is a free service we give to our listeners and our fans. As well, check out the news blog, CKUWnews.ca, which is mostly from, well, all from People of Interest or Warning Shots is the content where that comes from. So as I said at the top of the show, CKUW is a listener-driven media source. We take listener-driven very seriously. That means that not only are you supporting us by listening right now, but we also rely on your donations every February during Fund Drive. So you can get a hold of me, call 204-774-6877 during the show. I always like to hear questions, comments, concerns, all that kind of stuff. Of course, these things are pre-recorded, so the phone line will be open for the hour to get a hold of me. You can also contact me via email, warningshots.ckuw959@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, at warningshots. I also suggest that you follow CKUW on Twitter as well, at CKUW. Now, that's just all the little housekeeping kind of things that I like to get out of the way before we get right into it, which... our first segment, of course, is your international news in brief. So let's take a look at some of the news happening around the world right now. With the computer here, so no music for the news briefs, but nonetheless, now let's take a look at some of the news happening around the world right now. AllAfrica.com reports Mali's interim president Dion Kouda Tare played down a UN report that charges that his country's troops have carried out reprisals against some ethnic groups during the French-led offensive in the north. Since France, Malian, and West African troops drove Islamic groups out of most of the country's north, which they had control for several months, ethnic groups have been targeted for reprisals, according to the preliminary findings of a UN mission to Mali last month. Members of the Tuareg Arab ethnic groups have been targeted, says the Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights in the UN. Which he told this to the Human Rights Council in Geneva on Tuesday. And the Stars and Stripes is reporting that the United States Special Operations Task Force in Africa has changed commanders. Marine Corps Colonel George Bristol, a trained sniper and martial arts master who for the past year has overseen a U.S. Special Operations Task Force in Africa, had a message for his troops before heading off to retirement. He said an evil has descended on Africa, and it is up on us to stomp it out. For all the talk of the U.S. military's pivot to the Pacific, it is Africa and the growing threat posed by Islamic militant groups that now has the attention of special operations community. On Wednesday, Bristol relinquished command of the Joint Special Operations Task Force Trans-Sahara, which is at the center of the military's fight against extremist groups operation across the Sahel. Air Force Colonel Kenneth G. Shipley assumed command of the task force during a ceremony at AFRICOM headquarters in Stuttgart, Germany. Africa is not a ridgeline, Bristol said in an interview before Wednesday's ceremony. It is where the enemy is going now, and we are going to do something about it. Admiral Brian Lossley, commander of Special Operations Command Africa, which oversees the Trans-Sahara Task Force, credited Bristol with spearheading the understaffed task force through a tumultuous year, dealing with a number of crises that didn't hit the press, he said, suggesting not all were as high-profile as the situation in Mali that sparked the French intervention. Over the past 2 years, AFRICOM has been steadily building up its forces in the Horn of Africa, Libya, Algeria, Nigeria, and Mali. A special-purpose marine group task force tailored for crisis response missions is slated to join the command, and last week, AFRICOM Commander General Carter Ham said that there are also plans to strategically position other operations at separate locations on the continent. And that is just some of the news happening around the world right now. Do stay tuned. We will have more with Jawar Mohammed on political and religious freedom in Ethiopia. This is Warning Shots, CKW's independent international news show, and you are tuned right now to CKW 95.9 FM. Keep it locked here.
Tune in to Groundswell Radio every Monday afternoon from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. From integral serialism to post-minimalism to improvised electroacoustics and everything beyond and in between, Groundswell Radio opens your ears to the world of new music. Interviews with composers, rarely heard recordings, and so much more. Sit back and listen to something new and different on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Time for a CETA myth-busting fact from the Council of Canadians.
Harper's myth: CETA would not prevent Canada's municipal governments from sourcing goods and services locally.
CETA fact: the procurement rules in CETA will prohibit any covered government or public agency from preferring one bidding firm over another based on the amount of Canadian or local content in the goods or services being offered.
Call your MLA. Go to Canadians.org for more information.
So simple.
It's time to register your vote in this year's People's Choice category for CKUW's Volunteer Awards. Follow the link on our website, ckuw.ca, to let us know your favorite locally produced spoken word show, your favorite music show, your favorite radio host, and your favorite special performance in 2012. Voting ends April 7th. And we are back after that short commercial break. This is Warning Shots, CKW's independent international news show. I am your host, Scott Price. Now we will turn to the main content of the show. So last Saturday, there was an event all about religious freedom, political freedom, women's rights in Ethiopia. So there were numerous speakers, but specifically we're going to play for you a speech given by Jawar Mohammed, who is an independent researcher. He's a recent graduate of Stanford University. I believe he currently teaches at Carleton University. He's a a lot of research on federalism and political party systems as well. He's a human rights and social justice activist and has published numerous articles on Ethiopia. He's been on Al Jazeera, so he's quite well known as far as a commentator on Ethiopian goings-ons and what the current situation is. So this is the speech that Jawar gave at this event on Saturday, which was put together in part by the Ethiopian political prisoners and a refugee group, which one of the main guys there that organizes that is Ali Said, who's been on the show a couple of times. So this is Jawar Mohammed speech, and it was recorded by our CKW news director Michael Welsh. So big thank you to Michael, and so here is Jawar Mohammed.
Next to the stage, I want to call on Brother Jawar Mohammed. He's an independent researcher and a recent graduate of Stanford University who has also attended Oxford, where he did his research on federalism and political party system. Jawar has appeared on Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera English, BBC, CBC, CNN, VOA, and a number of other networks. He provides regular commentary on issues of human rights and social justice in the Horn of Africa and has published numerous articles in Ethiopia, and he is the founder of the Gulele Post. Please, a warm welcome for Brother Jawar Mohammed.
So tonight, I'm asked to give a brief overview or an introduction about the conflict, basically the confrontation between the Ethiopian Muslim community, between the Ethiopian Muslim community and the Ethiopian government. I'll be speaking what are the motives, why is the government doing what it's doing, what are the methods it's employing on both sides, both on the government side and the Muslim protester side. And finally, I will be speaking about what are the consequences or the outcomes so far. When we look at the current conflict, which started about 13 months ago, it didn't just erupt all of a sudden. There was a simmering problem. Some of the historical issues the brothers who spoke before me has mentioned it, but I just want to limit my discussion to the current government, which came about 21 years ago. The roots of the current confrontation can be traced back to 1995, when the government started taking over the religious institutions. Before I go into that, let me just mention about the nature of the relationship between the current government and religious communities, all religious communities. As many of the Ethiopians and those who are familiar with the country know, until 1975, we used to have established church, a state church. That was discontinued in 1975, and there was religious equality was declared as the state became secular. The communist government kind of treated all religions fairly, equally, but suppressed all of them. When the current government came, they liberalized the religious sphere. They allowed particularly private practice became free. People can show their identity, they can preach whatever they do. So this was this gained the regime a lot of support from previously marginalized religious communities like Muslims and Protestants. However, this expansion in the individual freedom, individual religious freedom, there is also a second hand into it. What the government did was it allowed people, individuals, to practice their religion, but established a very strict direct control over religious institutions. For example, in 1992, the government removed the head of the Orthodox Church. According to the church law, the patriarch must die before he can be replaced. But what this government did was remove him and replace him by a person known to be closely allied with the rising ruling elites. From then, from 1992, it moved to the Muslim community. First, they tried to co-opt the Muslim leaders. They were able to co-opt some, but they could not do well among others. Therefore, they instigated a conflict in the Grand Anwar Mosque in 1995. There was a riots, and that riots allowed them to eliminate clergies, clerics, sheikhs who are considered hostile to the government and replace them by individuals who are supposed to be loyal. This action of filling the majlis, the majlis is a central organization that serves the Muslims all over the country. It's filled through election by people. But what the government did was fill it with loyal cadres. When they were filling them, the only criteria they relied on was loyalty to the party. There was nothing about their competency, their acceptance to society, their knowledge of religion was not taken into consideration. What this led to growing corruption, the misappropriation of funding. The spiritual leaders start to appear in places where they are not expected, where this community considered it morally unacceptable. And they were largely known for working like a government cadre, like a ruling party cadre, rather than representatives of the Muslim community. So this led to a growing protest, and people said, we need election and we need to replace them. So in 2000, there was supposed to be an election. During this election, delegates have to be elected from local organization, local community mosques. It so happened that those delegates who would come to the capital and elect the senior leadership were largely made up of people who are not considered loyal to the party. Guess what the government did? The government moved on and canceled the election. After canceling and indefinitely postponing the election, in 2001, they started actually appointing people openly. The government started appointing people without any kind of election. And the Muslim community started protesting, and when these young people of my age, started to emerge, they needed a spiritual guidance, but they could not receive that from the senior clerics. So they started protesting, and they started pressuring the elders, the community elders, to go and protest and demand the government to stage election. While this back and forth, protest and response and negotiation was going on, interesting things started to happen in the region. The first thing was Ethiopia invaded Somalia in 2006. That had serious backlash because Ethiopia and Somalia had historical enmity. They have fought multiple wars over a border. The Ethiopia's invasion of Somalia in the name of fighting some Muslim group created a more monstrous sounding group called Al-Shabaab. So among the American foreign policy people, a serious discussion came. They said, using Ethiopia to deal with Somalia is not really helping us. It's creating even a more complicated situation. So then a strategy shift came in American foreign policy, and the Americans started using Kenya and Uganda as a primary proxy in dealing with Somalia, changing the practice of 15 years. And Ethiopia was receiving a lot of political support from the U.S., a lot of financial support, military support for handling the Somalia portfolio. So loss of this support, material and political support, was significant. So two things. On one side, there is a restless Muslim community that is demanding independence of the institution, which the government, by its design, does not want. On the other hand, there is also a change of global alliance in that region. So the government said they started. They needed to do something about the Muslims. One, they wanted to create a Muslim portfolio within Ethiopia itself, a Muslim issue within Ethiopia itself. Ironically, although Islam and Muslim has become a hot issue over in the global politics over the last 10 years, the Ethiopian Muslims have been too quiet. There is nothing happening. So the Ethiopian government could not really claim anything about terrorism. Now, they have to create terrorists in Ethiopia in order to bring the West. The West has to have vital interest in Ethiopia, not as a strategic ally for regional problems. But there has to be domestic problem that will keep the West entangled in there. So because they wanted to deal with this, they brought the Alabash group, the people were speaking earlier. So why did they bring the Alabash group to Ethiopia? The Alabash, as my brother earlier said, are a group that are a little different from the rest of the Muslim teachings. And what attracted, around 2007, 2008, the Ethiopian government was engaged in studying what kind of Muslim movement to bring to Ethiopia. And the Alabash was the winner. Why? They teach, they focus on submission to government. Their teaching method is, and even in the Middle East, they are allied with dictators like Assad. They teach communities to be submissive to dictatorship. So remember, the government wants the Muslim community to be submissive. So bringing this education is important for the primary, for one of the objectives. The second objective is also because they are so notoriously controversial, they are involved in so many confrontations with various Muslim groups in the Middle East, and they are well known among Ethiopians because the guys from Ethiopia, and he has historical conflict with the established Muslim communities. Bringing him would create immediate reaction from Ethiopian Muslims. And that reaction from a community that is largely made up of young people, 70% of the Muslim community or Ethiopian community are young people, could easily be turned into a violent confrontation. If you can create a violent confrontation involving security forces and Muslim people, you have a terrorism. And if you have terrorism, you have the American dollars flowing down. So they brought this Alabash, and they started imposing it using the majlis. You already have a majlis that's dreaded and hated by the people. Now you bring a religion that is highly, highly controversial and opposed by the community, and trying to impose it using the government security, using money, forcing the clergy to attend this indoctrination campaign. So when the government started this, the Muslim youth started. It created huge nationwide discourse. People started to say, what, in 21st century you can't do that? So people started opposing them. And this growing voice in rural area started to emerge in public protest in Aulia College, which is the only Muslim college in the country. When this protest erupted, the government took another step that escalated the conflict. What did they do? They fired the teachers who are teaching them, and they fired them, and they also took Aulia College, a community-run organization. It's not a government organization. They put it under the majlis. Now you have the only independent institution in the country comes into this corrupted institution, and the students started saying something is going on, so they expanded their question. They said, we need the majlis to be elected, we need Alabash to end, and we need to be given back our control of the Aulia College. So when they started protesting, the government started talking about things that were very strange in Ethiopia. They started to say Ethiopian Muslims are radicalized, Ethiopian Muslims have become Wahhabis, Ethiopian Muslims are infiltrated. All of a sudden, over the last 15 years, we have a lot of very active transnational Muslim militant groups in the region. Not a single Ethiopian was found among them. Not a single one. So the government couldn't tell that story. So then they started to arrest some smugglers from the Kenya border area, and some strange people from other places started saying, we have found Al-Qaeda cells. And they moved from that, starting accusing the protesters as these radicals who are trying to establish an Islamic government. So Muslim intellectuals in the cities took a very decisive step. They saw this is serious. This is not just a government trying to use its own trick to control the majlis, but this is a government with a larger agenda that will affect national security as well as the interest and security of Muslim people. So they came together and they developed a strategy that took on the government's terror narrative head on. And what did they do? They decided to take, we are going to wage a strictly disciplined nonviolent protest, and they brought the Muslim ulama, the Muslim clerics, and they passed fatwa saying, no violence, we're going to stick to nonviolence. Therefore, when you stick in nonviolence, you hit the militant jihadist narrative. They elected these leaders, the leaders you saw earlier, they elected them in public. There was about, I think, 20 to 30,000 people when they elected them. From then, they went all around the country and they collected 1 million votes, signatures, endorsing these leaders as legitimate representatives. After they're elected, they wrote a 70-page document detailing their demands, and they met with all levels of the government officials. Agreement could not be reached, and the government continued to intensify its repression. Then they side by side with this nonviolent, the other step they took is, and what the government was telling in this media was, these are extremely hardline Muslim jihadists who are here to Islamize the country, to slaughter the Christians, which strokes with some of bad memories from history. So they started working with the Christians, and they avoided horizontal conflict and assured the Christian community. And they also framed the question as a secular demand. Instead of religious demand, they made a secular humanist demand. Basically, they started demanding their demand to be a constitutional based on the Ethiopian constitution and international law. They use those languages. What that has done was completely undermine what the government was trying to sell, the terror narrative. When this protest became so popular, in Ethiopian history, we are known for fighting. War is the way you solve the problems, particularly this kind of political contest. All of a sudden, in the world where Muslims are known to be, if they are pissed off, they'll just blow up the bomb, that's the sentiment that was created over the last 10, 15 years, you have these Muslim people come out every Friday, they protest peacefully, the police comes, beats them, they don't fight back, and it created a story. It created a very interesting story. And then you have this foreign journalists and the UN people who are there. Initially, they bought into the government rhetoric about Wahhabis, about militant, here and there. But week after week, people maintained this nonviolent discipline. They became so annoying to the government because they refused to bite into what the government was preparing. So the government decided to push it further. And they said, okay, if I pinch them, they're not responding. I punch them again, they are not responding. I gotta crush their bones so that it would be so painful they will respond. So they started this heavy crackdown in the city to intimidate people, drive the hope of achieving their goals through violence. They arrested all the leadership. They intensified the defamation campaign. They started to take over all the institutions. There are about 10 or so Muslim civic organizations. They closed down all of this. Still, after the leadership was arrested, after all this crackdown happened, after a number of people were killed, after the mosques were desecrated, the people remained nonviolent. So now they suspected that the local, especially the clan level, lower level clerics, the imams, are responsible for organizing this. So they said, if we can take over all of these mosques, there will be no problem. So they started doing the unimaginable. You know, when I was growing up, somebody who goes, studies Quran, comes home, and he's a farmer, and if he has some good knowledge, people like him, people build a mosque for him, he becomes imam. We never had imam appointed for us, not by government, but even nobody has ever appointed imam in that country. Now the government has started appointing imams in the smallest mosque in the country. And they are engaged in some of the most hateful Islamophobic speeches, propagandas that you cannot see on Fox News. You cannot see it on Tea Party bullshit. You know, you cannot find that kind of stuff. Excuse my language. What that has done is actually, instead of hurting the struggle, some magic came to work, the magic of remaining really disciplined and violent. It started to piss off the Christian community. The Christian community, every Friday they see these people, if there is a Christian holiday, they don't protest. If there is a Christian celebration at the church, they don't pass by there, they do it in a different mosque. The Christians started to come out and support them. And the lawyers, the civic community in the country started to work with them. So, At this moment, we are at a very interesting point where the government is completely confused. They tried crackdown, it didn't work. They tried to bribe people, it didn't work. They tried to shut it down by putting people in jail. It didn't work. So we are in a stage where the government is still contemplating, where the movement has become so mature, it's not that easy to crack it down, where the country's population has become quite aware and quite conscious about the government's motive, that the government is worried if they keep... If they let it go, they are worried that the Christian community, the political parties, and others will support. One of the most interesting things is the Ethiopian political parties are known to not agree on anything. We have, 600 parties or something. The one issue they have agreed on in the last 20 years was this one issue. All of them, from the most conservative to the most liberal, from the ethno-nationalist to the most unitarist groups, have supported it. So now the government is contemplating in what step to take. So when we are heading forward, what kind of things we might expect? For the government, I don't think there is any alternative than to resolve this issue by answering the questions. If they continue with this path of misrepresentation and repression and exaggerating and it's kind of creating animosity between the state institution and the government, there is a real chance that the protest can expand beyond the Muslim community, beyond the realm of the religious freedom, the demand for religious freedom. It could go into larger political question, and it could endanger the government. It's also unifying the opposition. This could happen. On the second, what I don't share, but a lot of people are starting to feel, is that if the government continue to repress, this could go into some violent confrontation. And I think that analysis is largely wrong. It comes from this assumption that you suppress them enough, Muslims will explode. I think what the Ethiopian Muslims have done, and what they have demonstrated shows that they have learned a lesson from mistakes of other Muslim communities in the world in the last 10 years. They have learned that the best way to counter prejudice is not really to feed it, is to undermine it, to teach the world that actually there is a better way of fighting. Another point that is of concern, and that I'm not sure what happened, is the response of the international community. The international community has a muted response. Initially, they jumped on the government bandwagon. After that, they remained completely quiet. You have journalists in there who don't write anything about it. You have governments. I haven't seen a single government so far that has written a statement, despite the whole Obama and everybody's talk about nonviolence, about youth aspirations, about fighting militarism and all this. We haven't seen any statement. Moving forward, what kind of response they will bring highly depends on, one, whether the Muslim community can continue to remain independent of any external influence, whether they continue to stick into their nonviolent methods. Also, whether you and diaspora continue to work towards raising awareness like you are doing right now. The Muslim community has no other alternative than to remain on the path that has been so effective. It has lifted, really, aside defeating the narrative of the government. What it did was it changed public perception of Islam and Muslim in Ethiopia, where Muslims were considered marginal, hostile, and the suppressed people. The admiration, the respect they are earning by remaining nonviolent, by remaining unified, by remaining so creative in so many ways, I think they are winning. And I think it's very important that you tell your young brothers and sisters to continue on the path. Finally, I just want to touch on I don't want to finish this without talking directly to you about the diaspora. The diaspora has been amazingly effective in what you have done, what you are continuing to do is very important. I just want to remind you again, you are not the leader of this movement. You guys are not, we are not here to lead, we are here to support. And we can do this support in two ways. One is material support. The people have lawyers right now, we have thousands of people in jail right now who need to be fed. We have the leadership who have to be defended. There are a number of lawsuits that are challenging the government that have to be financed. So we need a lot of money. We need a lot of your hard-earned money. to support them, you have to continue to work with that. Material, when I say material, is not just money. Technology. Look at what your sisters are doing in that country. They are using the cheapest phone possible. There was one incident, just to encourage you to give technology back to our society. There was one incident when the government was staffing a room with guns to say that these protesters were preparing to launch armed insurrection in the country. And it so happened some smart sister had her phone, she just put it on a charge and left the camera there, and the camera recorded it. And they used that to tell the government, if you do this and then make it look like we did it, you will be in trouble. So the government didn't do that. So this kind of little work need to be done, and you need to support your sisters and brothers back home through technology. And finally, but you know, finally and most importantly, you need to do this outreach. You need to do advocacy. And when you do advocacy, it's not just to gather support, but also to learn tactics, especially Canadians. You know, in America, we're a bit different, but in Canada, where there's a lot of social movements, the Native people movement, the labor movement, from these movements, the immigration movement, from these movements, we need to learn tactics, we need to learn strategy so that we can bring it back to our society, we can bring knowledge to our society, and our society can advance their interest, protect their country, protect their interest, and protect their economy without being dragged into the path of violence and destruction. So we have to work on that. And I also want to remind you that Canada is highly involved in Ethiopia, particularly in the mining sector. They have been involved in the mining sector. You have to use, as Canadians, Ethiopians, you have to use your voice, your tax dollars, to influence the Canadian policy, the Canadian corporation, the Canadian government, to have a positive influence on the government, to put human rights, protection of human rights, protection of freedom, part of the economic and the foreign policy package, so that the whatever money you give from here and your brothers and sisters in this country give doesn't end up financing terror and repression and dictatorship, but also finances development, grows democracy and development. I just want to finish by this, and thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Have a great day.
And that was Jawar Mohammed on some of the things that are going on in Ethiopia recently in terms of religious freedom, political freedom. Of course, the long-serving president, Meles Zenawi, died a couple months ago, which we talked about here on air. So that was him kind of giving sort of a breakdown of some of these different movements and specifically concentration on the religious aspect of it. Now, here is Michael Welsh's interview with Jawar, also on the Saturday that he caught up with him. So this is them kind of going a bit further about some of these issues. So here is Michael Welsh interviewing Jawar Mohammed.
Our listeners are familiar with the fact that the people of Ethiopia have been subjected to significant human rights abuses and repression for a very, very long time. I wonder if you could talk about the significance of the events over the last 14 months or so, and what we're seeing in this new nonviolent movement. Is this unprecedented in the history of Ethiopia?
It's very unprecedented. In the past, we have always been ruled by dictators over the last 100 years. People took two types of action. Either they submitted to repression or they insurrected through violence means. They picked up guns and they became rebels, basically. That's how the current government itself came to power, by overthrowing another dictator. What makes what has been happening in the last 14 months is, one, the fact that it's nonviolent, it's disciplined, it was sustainable, it was taking place every week, and also everybody is participating, old people, young people, women, the professionals, the business people, everybody is participating. The government assumed that by attacking the Muslims, it can pit them against their Christian brothers and sisters. Instead, what we observed is a growing solidarity, and the two communities came way closer. In my own experience as a person of dual faith, my mother being from Christian family, my father being Muslim, even for me, I saw Christians and Muslims getting way, way closer, discussing their issues and standing up against the tyranny together. So I think the role of nonviolence as one, by picking up nonviolent struggle, what the Muslims have done was eliminate a sense of threat from the Christians. They are not violent, and their demands are peaceful, constitutional, and legal. So it's targeted at the government. So the Muslims, the Christians start to see, look, these people are demanding very basic rights, rights we would demand. They are demanded in a peaceful way, and they are demanded it within their own mosque. So the Christians are supporting it, which is quite interesting by itself.
Are there any identifiable figures in this movement, the people you would point to, if not leaders, then certainly people who are very significant or important for the struggle?
The most interesting thing about this movement is the fact that it's faceless in most part. It started when the government harshly started imposing this foreign alien religion they brought from Lebanon. Students at one college started protesting. As the protest grew and became national, they came together and selected people from all walks of life. You have professors, teachers, business people, clan leaders, NGO workers. They represent all parts of the country. There are 17 people who are elected. They are called committee. They are called arbitration committee to arbitrate between the Muslim community and the government. So they do provide leadership. They are in jail, but you don't have a hero. You don't have a single individual at the center. These are just, they so happen to be there. And these young people needed leaders, needed somebody who can present their demand in a collective and centralized way to the government. They elected them, so that's the only reason they are leaders. They are not big heroes.
There's no Gandhi.
No, there's no Gandhi. What you have is ordinary individuals who were doing their business. For example, the chairman of the committee was a successful businessman who started from scratch and became a successful man, and they needed somebody who can lead them, and they called him up and lead us. And the other guy is a professor of history. The other guy is a legal scholar, a lawyer. So you have all these kind of people who are there by coincidence. The Muslims for a long time were inactive in that country. So when this activity came, they needed to deliver. The elite of society needed to step up and provide leadership, and that's what they did. Almost by accident, they represent the diverse background, and eventually some of them might become important people. But at this stage, the only importance they have is their commitment and their discipline, and they have shaped society to follow them.
Now, why would why would a tyrannical government seem to want to manipulate people's religion? How does that help them maintain their control?
The current government that's in power, it has a very tiny social base. It has an ethnic insurgency representing an ethnic group that makes up about 5% of the Ethiopian population. So they have a very narrow base. The reason they have stayed in power for the last 21 years is by manipulating the various ethnic identities, by creating rivalry and fighting and competition among ethnic groups. What happened, however, is over the last 2, 3, 4 years, people start to say, hold on, these guys are just making mess among us, and they're suppressing, oppressing, and exploiting all of us. So people started to narrow down, the political parties, ethnic parties started to narrow down. So one of the reasons why they are doing this is to create another source of division by bringing religion into to the mix. But there is also another more important. A lot of the tyrant governments in the world right now, they get a lot of financial support from the West because they are important allies, supposed to be allies on war on terror. And Ethiopia happened to be America's proxy in messing with Somalia for a long time. However, in recent years, America started using Kenya as a proxy for Somalia. And the money and the funding that was going to Ethiopia started to shift towards Kenya. So the Ethiopian government dictatorship said, oh, we need to keep America bogged down in here. Therefore, we have to create a religion, an issue in here. We have to scare the Americans that the Muslims are coming, the radicals are coming. You got to keep pumping your dollar to us. So that is one of the other reasons, which is actually the primary reason why they are doing this.
Okay, interesting. So that sounds similar to I guess it was 1970s, 1980s, Afghanistan, famously, they had, it was a secular state, but then they brought in all these foreign Islamic interests, and then it became very much, I guess, infected by what I understand to be a very foreign influence. Are there any, you're just taking that example of Afghanistan, are you able to maybe see, similarities and differences between Afghanistan and Ethiopia as far as that, you know, manipulation?
There is a manipulation, but the manipulation is reversed. In the past, it was the Americans who used to manipulate different countries. Now, dictators have become so smart, they are manipulating America itself. What they're doing is they're just shouting there is terrorists here, and if there are terrorists, American dollar will go there. So what this guy has done in Somalia itself is, the Ethiopian government has been messing Somalia for a long time because they don't want Ethiopia's insurgents to have a base in Somalia, and they have been pitting warlords against warlords for a long time. In 2006, when the clan leaders came together and created some sort of government, the Ethiopian government went and invaded it and turned that more moderate Islamic movement into hardline Al-Shabaab terrorist group. So the manipulation seemed to have been reversed. The Americans are being taken really for a ride. And what they attempted in Ethiopia and failed, what the government tried to do is actually bring this highly controversial and offensive group from in 21st century. You can't bring religion and impose on people. And what the government thought was, if I bring this controversial group and impose it on the Ethiopian Muslims, the young people will rebel and they will have another militant Islamic group in Ethiopia. However, Ethiopia is not Afghanistan. Ethiopia is not Somalia. It's a society that has developed well-established mechanisms of coexistence and peaceful coexistence. So when the government thought they will go to rebellion and violence, the young people turned that all anger into some creative, peaceful resistance. So they defeated the whole narrative. They became very, very powerful by avoiding violence, by becoming so disciplined. Non-violence is something the government did not anticipate. The government has no weapon to suppress it. So they closed down opportunities both for the Ethiopian government to exploit it, but also for external Islamist elements to come in. Because when there is no violence, Islamists have no reason to come. When there is no violence, dictators have no reason to milk dollars from there. So it's an interesting antidote between the two.
Now, talking about the United States and other Western governments, do they have an involvement in Ethiopia beyond just being an easy source of funds for the quote-unquote anti-terrorism crackdowns?
I don't believe they have that much of an involvement at this stage. Earlier, they were involved in rising false alarm about growing fundamentalism and so on and so on. What they assessed as a fundamentalism was actually a Muslim awakening. For a long time, the Islamic religion, the Muslim society were left out from much of the state, much of the apparatus, and they did not have a lot of educational access. But over the last couple of decades, they have access to education. The more access they have to education, and the more globalization brought in a lot of materials, people start reading their religion, people start to be proud of their religion, they start showing their religious identity out there. And it's, of course, it's a change from the past. However, all of the academics and the scholars who studied there saw this as more of a reformist movement, a kind of an awakening of a new generation of Muslims who are trying to assert their identity in the country as opposed to be more militant and internationalist movement. So the Americans raised that false alarm and kind of gave a signal to the Ethiopian government to step up. But after they step up, what the Americans, I think, realized is that they were wrong initially, because these people are nonviolent, these people are disciplined, and the leadership of this movement are highly qualified individuals, very moderate, secular, and some of them known for publishing books, criticizing any kind of fundamental ideology, known for preaching tolerance and coexistence among the population. So the Americans seem to be a little more secure today than they used to be before they started doing more real assessment on the society.
So what is the end game here? If the movement prevails, will we see a change that goes beyond the demands of the Muslim community? And, I mean, are we going to see the whole issue of the disappeared being addressed, a change in government? Where do you see, is this likely to go?
I think it changed the whole human rights campaign in Ethiopia. In the past, people used to go to jail. We in here in diaspora will publish, we will protest. That's it. What it did is, for the first time in the country's history, people in the country rose up and said in a very disciplined way, in a constitutional way, they came out and said no. So they changed the political confrontation from either submission or armed uprising. They created it created a civic room, a real room for civilians, for normal people, for the mothers, fathers, teachers to say, enough is enough. I want my right back. And it infused this positive energy of optimism into the population far and beyond the Muslim community. It showed people that it is possible to say no to the government. It's possible to be unified, to work together. You don't have to be a hero. What the struggle for democracy, what struggle for human rights requires is millions of heroes, not one single hero. So that you have these millions of people who probably don't know each other, come every day. If you look at their slogan, it's so diverse. There is a woman who talks about her woman right, as we saw today. There is old man who say, you know, I want my father's religion. There is young man who says, I want education. So you have all of these people coming out and expressing them. So it is having, it is becoming contagious. So you are observing the journalists, the various professions that are oppressed, using this language of civic resistance inside the country. And the other thing that happened is, because you mentioned about the prisoners, is once these Muslim leaders went to jail, they are kept together with the various political prisoners. From a single Oromo ethnic group, there are 25,000 political prisoners in jail. There are journalists in jail. There are doctors in jail. So these people are living together now. They are learning from each other. They are building solidarity in jail. And out here, their supporters, both in the country and out here, now unified. So you have a Muslim who is not just fighting for freedom of religion, but also for freedom of political prisoner, because their leaders are in jail. So you have a journalist association that is fighting not only for the journalists, but also for this Muslim journalist. So you have like this interlinked movement emerging. What will be the long-term consequence? I'm not sure, but if the government continues to suppress, and if the movement continues on this nonviolent path, I think the government will lose credibility very fast. Over the last years, they have been in a crisis. The whole movement has become the top priority, the top agenda of the government. So if they continue to suppress it, try to suppress it, which they can't, they might lose. Friction might emerge within the ruling elite itself. We are already observing some sign of a breakdown. So in the long run, it's possible that the rest of the country will join in and perhaps get rid of the government.
Jawar Mohammed, thank you very much for shedding some light on these historically significant events happening in your home country. Thank you very much.
Yes, and that was the interview that that Michael Welsh did with Jawar Mohammed. But we are at the end of the show now, so just close it out. So you heard today on Warning Shots a speech by Jawar Mohammed, as well as an interview talking about the growing political and social movement in Ethiopia, and sort of the broad base that it holds, both as far as politics and religion, as that interview just was talking about. So that was the show for today. Next week, hopefully more on Ethiopia, specifically on the displacement of people in southern Ethiopia to build a couple different development projects, which is, if you kind of go through the line, is essentially funded by the World Bank. But hopefully we'll have some, I'll have some stuff there for you on that. That'll be next week. But in the meantime, there's a couple ways that you can get a hold of people here at CKUW, questions, comments, or concerns. There's the office phone number, 786-204-786-9782. You can also get a hold of our news director, Michael Welsh, ckuwnews@rocketmail.com. Get a hold of me, warningshots.ckuw959@gmail.com. That's warningshots.ckuw959@gmail.com. And then also follow me on Twitter @warningshots. You can find me there. Follow CKUW on Twitter @CKUW to find out what's going on. So that was the show for today. Thank you for listening and supporting listener-driven media public access media like CKUW. Of course, coming up will be the Community Cupboard, and then there's Mercy of Slumber, Now Sounds, and Peg City Groove. So keep it locked here on CKUW 95.9 FM for your Friday afternoon. And then I'll be in the booth again next Friday to talk a bit more about things going on in Ethiopia. So next couple weeks, we'll have some more Ethiopian coverage, and then hopefully maybe have Jawar Mohammed back on again to talk. But yeah, that's what you can expect in the next couple weeks. Yeah, so until next Friday, you know, have a safe and fun weekend and week. And yeah, and I hope to be able to provide international news to you all next Friday as well. So until then, bye-bye and take care.
Grab yourself a pen and some paper. It's time for CKW's Community Cupboard. Announcements and resources from and in your community. If you have a public service announcement or community resource to share, contact us at 786-9782 or email ckuw@uwinnipeg.ca.
And here is your Community Cupboard. The Rupert's Land Caregiver Services are starting their Ring a Ride program in the spring. This program needs volunteers to drive drivers to take clients residing in Southwest Winnipeg to appointments, shopping, and social outings. Compensation for gasoline and parking is provided. Volunteers can be available as little or as much as they wish. Even once per month helps. For more information about this opportunity, please call 204-452-9491. And Light launches the Give Change to Make Change campaign. Small change adds up to big opportunities in Winnipeg's inner city and North End. Light is launching their Give Change to Make Change program in an effort to raise funds for their community economic development grant programs, otherwise known as SEED. So what they're asking for is for all of your unwanted unwanted change, hence like pennies, which are going, which are, have gone the way of the dodo. So Light hopes to raise $4,000 through the initiative. So donations are being accepted at the Light office at 765 Main Street through the months of February and March. Alternatively, pickups can be arranged. If you're interested in donating or for more information, please contact Sarah, the development coordinator at